This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, the Illinois River will be shut down during lock and dam construction work next year. That leaves farmers who rely on it to ship grain in a bind. We'll hear how farmers are being warned to plan ahead. Illinois has been losing college students to schools in other states, like Carthage College in Wisconsin.
We are close enough to home that they can still, you know, get home on a, you know, a random weekend if they needed to. But yet, they're out of state, so they're getting that going away to campus feel.
What can Illinois do to stem the tide of falling enrollments? We'll find out more about what's known as the Illinois Innovation Network, and we'll hear how some rural communities are working to make sure they have access to fresh food. Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, when students leave Illinois to go to college, what locations are benefiting? We'll take a look at that issue. Also, farmers who rely on the Illinois River for shipping need to be prepared for a shutdown of the waterway next year. We'll hear more about that. And food deserts, they're not just a problem for urban areas. Those who live in rural parts of Illinois are having difficulty finding places to shop for fresh produce. What some towns are doing about it. That and more coming up on this episode of Statewide. First this week, the Illinois legislature has appropriated $500 million to the University of Illinois for an endeavor known as Discovery Partners Institute and the Illinois Innovation Network. That first part, DPI, requires building a new high-tech facility in downtown Chicago. The second part, the Illinois Innovation Network, involves collaboration among all the four-year public universities. But what will these projects really mean, and how will the funds be divvied up? Our education reporter Dusty Rhodes sat down with the University of Illinois Vice President Ed Seidel to find out.
Try to explain this like you're not at an academic conference. Mm-hmm. So you're talking to a guy driving a truck down the road.
Okay.
What is it?
So the Illinois Innovation Network and the Discovery Partners Institute are a collection of universities across the state. So we're trying to create an environment that brings together partners from every university in the state to major universities around the world to work together with companies to enhance what they can do and to increase entrepreneurship and create more companies in the state, things like that.
And the legislature has appropriated $500 million so far for this. I mean, in my world, that's a lot of money.
That is a lot of money, and we're really fortunate that the state, I think, has agreed to support this activity. And I think they're doing it because they see that by having not just the University of Illinois, but all the four-year public universities, major laboratories like Argonne National Lab, and then incredible international partners are coming together to assemble all the talent that we can muster to address some of the challenges that the state has.
Okay, some of the best universities in the world, like who?
Tel Aviv University in Israel, Hebrew University also in Israel, Cardiff University in the UK, there's Ramaya Medical University in India. Those are the current signed ones. There's several others that are in discussions that I'm confident will be signed in time.
It all sounds great, but a lot of it sounds like things you could have done anyway. So how's this not something you could have done anyway? I mean, the one part that sounds like it actually needed money to happen is you're going to build a new building, DPI.
The $500 million that's coming from the state, so roughly half of that is going into the site in Chicago, and the other half is being distributed in innovation centers or research centers across all of the four-year public universities in the state.
You're saying roughly half the money will go to this building in Chicago. So roughly how much does each hub get?
Well, so the DPI itself gets the most money, and then so Urbana, Champaign campus, and Chicago campus have roughly similar amounts of money in terms of how much they're getting.
Which is how much?
Well, it's of order $100 million. I don't know the exact figure now, but...
So that gets us up to 450, so then there's like $50 million left for...
$50 million for the other hubs. So there's smaller amounts of money, but in each case, there's something significant that's being done. Usually it's money that's being used to renovate a space.
It kind of sounds like you got a pizza and you're cutting it up. How did you figure out how much each hub got?
Well, I would say, first of all, the U of I conceived this project, but as a statewide project. So from the beginning, we had in mind that we would involve other universities across the state. So we did think about what we needed in order to build the site in Chicago, and then what we needed to support the programs that we have in mind at the different sites. And we did carve out 10% of this money for other public universities, and we intend to help them raise money in addition. So it's not just, we think the $500 million, it's not like a fixed pot. We're going to grow this over time. It's our feeling that the hubs are actually very happy that the university is reaching out to them to bring them in and say, this is a statewide effort. So we really think now it's not a zero-sum game or it's not a fixed pie. We're growing the pie because we're working together.
Ed Seidel is the Vice President for Economic Development and Innovation at the University of Illinois, and he spoke with our Dusty Rhodes. Illinois is the third state to require graduating high school seniors fill out what's known as the Free Application for Federal Student Aid, also known as FAFSA form. Lee Gaines has more.
Illinois is following in the footsteps of Louisiana. Since mandating students complete the form in their senior year of high school, Louisiana now has the highest FAFSA completion rate in the country. Texas lawmakers passed a similar bill this summer. State Senator Andy Menar sponsored the legislation in Illinois. It takes effect with the 2020-21 school year. He says the new law will encourage schools to work with students on their post-high school plans. Menar, a Central Illinois Democrat, says that's important for low-income students.
It's going to break down those barriers for the students on the end of the spectrum today that don't have that clear, unambiguous path forward to what happens to them after high school.
Illinois schools will still award diplomas to high school seniors who can't complete the form due to extenuating circumstances. I'm Lee Gaines.
Nearly half of Illinois public high school graduates enrolled in four-year universities leave the state for college. The competition from out-of-state schools to attract Illinois students is fierce. Illinois universities and colleges are hoping they can start to win them back. Peter Medlin has details.
A few years ago, when he was going to Yorkville High School, Matt Pistick saw college recruiters roaming his school that surprised him and made his friends laugh. They were recruiters from a university more than 700 miles away, the University of Alabama.
I remember when I first saw it, like, we all just joked about, like, oh, ha, ha, yeah, University of Alabama. But then like, you look into it and it's like, oh, actually, you know what? Maybe that's not a bad idea.
And it was the scholarships they were willing to offer that got his attention. He says he sent in his ACT scores and eventually received a letter telling him he'd gotten a full ride scholarship. Around a decade ago, 45 first-time Illinois college students enrolled at the University of Alabama. Fast forward to today, and the university has catapulted into the top 10 out-of-state schools where Illinois students go. By 2016, that 45 had turned into 464 new students a year.
One of my best friends down there is from Des Plaines. One of our other friends is from Granite City, and there's a lot of people at Alabama from Illinois.
According to the Chicago Tribune, Alabama gave full-ride scholarships to 203 Illinois freshmen in 2017. Pistick did apply to schools in Illinois, but they couldn't offer him close to what Alabama did.
No, I got nothing. I mainly applied to University of Illinois, and then my other one was Iowa State, but University of Illinois wouldn't give me anything at all.
Alabama is not the only out-of-state school that has pounced on the opportunity while Illinois has struggled with budget impasses and funding cuts. Far and away, the top school for Illinois students who leave is the University of Iowa. Nearly 1,700 first-time Illinois college students enrolled there in 2016. Another outlier in recruiting Illinois students is Carthage College. They're a small, private liberal arts school in Kenosha, Wisconsin. It's about 15 miles from the Illinois border. But like Iowa, they've been growing in the last few years. Last year, they welcomed their largest freshman class ever.
The majority of students are actually coming from outside of Wisconsin. And Illinois is that big draw.
That's Ashley Hansen. She's the Assistant Vice President of Admissions at Carthage. She says around 400 new Illinois students have been coming to Carthage every year for nearly a decade.
We are close enough to home that they can still, you know, get home on a random weekend if they needed to. But yet, they're out of state, so they're getting that going away to campus feel. So it's kind of, you know, the best of both worlds.
Back in Illinois, students are still leaving at an alarming rate, and enrollment at the state's public colleges and universities, which rely on state aid, has taken the biggest hit.
Some of this has to do with some external factors that aren't about the quality of institutions here.
Quentin Clay is the director of admissions at Northern Illinois University.
I don't want to deny the student an opportunity to see themselves in another place accomplishing a particular thing, interacting with all sorts of people. I don't want to deny that.
Clay says that the university's new strategic enrollment plan puts them in a realistic position to thrive, but he says it'll take change.
It's feasible, but it's going to be uncomfortable. I look to the day that we turn the page and we become proactive and predictive.
Even though Illinois' out-migration problem doesn't look to be going away anytime soon, he's glad that NIU is having the necessary conversations to combat it.
I don't think this is a conversation that's taboo or a negative conversation as somebody's done something wrong. I think we should fight after what we care about most, and that's our students, and that's our local populations.
Earlier this year, Governor J.B. Pritzker increased funding for the AIM High Grant Program to help ease the exodus. It provides merit scholarships to Illinois students at the state's public universities. I'm Peter Medlin.
Want to make sure you don't miss our show? A reminder that each week our podcast is available through the NPR One app. You can also find all of our episodes at statewideshow.com. President Donald Trump says he's very strongly considering a pardon for former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich. He spoke with reporters this week aboard Air Force One and said Blagojevich was, quote, treated unbelievably unfairly. Blagojevich was charged with corruption, then impeached and removed from office. He briefly appeared on Trump's reality show, The Celebrity Apprentice, before he was convicted by a jury and sentenced to 14 years in prison. Trump's not the only politician who thinks Blagojevich received too much time. Illinois U.S. Senator Dick Durbin, a Democrat, has previously said he would support a shorter sentence. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker has ordered a review of child welfare services after the high-profile deaths of several children earlier this year. Steph Whiteside reports that review revealed sweeping problems with the Department of Children and Family Services.
In late March, a child welfare worker visited the family home of 9-year-old Byron Casanova in Johnston City. He and his three siblings weren't removed despite the social worker expressing concerns about the environment. 4 days later, Byron Casanova was dead.
The intake workers there on the Tuesday before noted some things in the house and said, you know, that he was a little concerned about the cleanliness of the house.
This is Police Chief William Stark. He says he saw only one mattress for four children and two adults. There was no crib for Byron's infant sister.
When I got there on Saturday, if that's how it looked, I was very concerned about the cleanliness of the house.
Byron Casanova isn't the only child who has died this year.
A report showed that he and his other brother were doing okay inside their home.
Now you've probably heard the heartbreaking details around Tanasia's death.
Neighbors and former family friends say AJ Friend.
In the span of 3 years, the Department of Children and Family Services investigated the deaths of 102 children who had previously been in contact with the agency. Stark says he didn't know that DCFS was investigating the Casanova family. Stark says police in this small community could have kept a closer eye on the family if they'd known there were concerns about drugs and neglect.
We have confidential sources that we can rely on, and you know, we have neighbors that can talk a lot. We have tools that we can use if we only would know about it, that we needed to put those tools in use.
Stark's speaking out about the case to try and increase communication between child welfare workers and law enforcement. Byron's family had been referred to Intact Family Services. That's a voluntary program to keep children with families while they receive help, but families aren't required to work with them. That's one of the areas examined in a report from Chapin Hall, a policy research center at the University of Chicago. Dana Weiner worked on the report, which came out this May.
Illinois removes fewer kids from their homes than any other child welfare system in the country. So that means that we have a pretty high threshold for removing a child.
That isn't necessarily a bad thing, But the Chapin Hall report said that DCFS workers they talked to didn't think that recommending removal would be supported by courts or supervisors, even in cases where they thought it was appropriate. The report also found that if parents don't want to cooperate with Intact, there is no easy way to refer the case back to investigators for further review.
One of the concerning things that we found is that in those cases, there's no loop or pathway back to monitoring that case or revisiting whether the referral was appropriate.
The Chapin Hall report came shortly after a report from the Auditor General. That report found that between 2015 and 2017, the department investigated 102 child deaths. Those all involved children who died of suspected abuse or neglect and had previously been in contact with DCFS. So, should DCFS be more proactive in removing children from situations where they suspect abuse or neglect? Not necessarily. The Chapin Hall report recommends revisiting removal standards, but others involved in child welfare reform say this needs further study. The department has committed to making many of the recommended changes, Weiner says. A written plan provided by DCFS includes a commitment to changing internal procedures and structures, as well as hiring 43 new investigators. In Johnston City, Stark hopes that future tragedies can be prevented.
Their whole goal is, of course, reunification, is to get the kids back to the parents. I appreciate that. I understand that. I think that it needs to be there. But I think that the child's well-being needs to be looked at before all else.
Byron Casanova's brothers and sister were removed from the home. In June, parents of Byron's classmates began fundraising for a memorial bench in a local park that his friends and siblings can visit to remember him. Steph Whiteside, Illinois Newsroom.
The Illinois State Fair has begun its 10-day run in Springfield. The fair is an agricultural event, and there's plenty more to do as well, including grandstand shows and a lot of food. The fair is also offering a discount on admission for some weekdays. You can check the fair's website to get all the details. Once the Illinois State Fair is complete, the DuQuoin State Fair begins in southern Illinois. That's later this month. Just ahead on Statewide, harmonica therapy, how it can help those with respiratory problems. That's coming up. We're back on Statewide, and still coming up, we'll visit a clinic helping pregnant women deal with drug addiction. And later, a big portion of the Illinois River is set to close next year. What problems could that create, especially for farmers? We'll find out. Well, every month, a handful of people gather on Bloomington's east side to make music together. And as Willis Kern of member station WGLT reports, the tunes they produce are not headed to the top of the charts, but the sounds are likely to improve their lives.
That's Nashville-based singer-songwriter and harmonica player extraordinaire Chris Jansen. The three-time Academy of Country Music Award nominee suffers from asthma, and 3 years ago signed on to become the national spokesman for a program called Harmonicas for Health. It's an effort designed to help those with breathing difficulties improve quality of life by regularly blowing into what's known by some older users as a mouth harp. One such disease, chronic obstructive pulmonary disorder, or COPD, is the third leading cause of death, with an estimated 24 million sufferers in the United States alone. On the third Tuesday of each month, a half dozen or so Central Illinois residents, all with breathing difficulties, gather in a conference room at OSF St. Joseph Medical Center's cardiopulmonary wing.
Make sure that we're all sitting up straight, feet flat on the floor, shoulders back. Remember, in here, the darker numbers are actually your breathing in, and then the numbers that are outlined, you are breathing out. Okay, so you're blowing
today,
out.
Today, Kraft is leading the group, all puffing arduously into harmonicas supplied to them for free by OSF. Kraft says good posture is a must for improved breathing.
We really try to focus on really breathing deeply, making sure that they're using their full lung function. This is kind of just like a different spin that we throw on top of it, playing a harmonica, playing beautiful music.
But while practicing better breathing techniques is designed to help, Kraft says the harmonica therapy also creates a positive social activity for each individual.
The goals of it really are to try to keep people not only socializing with everybody, but also focusing on that deep breathing. Whether you have pulmonary hypertension or COPD or something like that, you really, really want to try to show them that using the harmonica, sucking in, blowing out, really is going to try to help with that COPD and the pulmonary hypertension.
One of the four harmonica players is Steve Peterson. The retired rural McLean County resident has played harmonica for years and has been coming to the harmonica therapy sessions since they began nearly a year ago. He helps a first-time participant learn how to hit the correct notes to When the Saints Go Marching In.
You know the song, yeah. So it's just like, well, you got to find the right note. It's hunk and peck, right, like a right, piano. It's right, like, right. Like, that isn't right, but that is right. So once you find it, your brain sends you back to that spot, you know. And
So again, too, I mean, when you're looking, yeah, see, we don't sound anything like that.
I don't know. No. Sound
very good.
No, you in a band? No, we're talking about us. No.
No, I sat around a campfire for 50 years.
Peterson says he's been battling breathing problems for years, but doctors have set him straight on just what to expect.
I got diagnosed 5 years ago. I had 50% lung function. I'm down to about 30%. So I don't have any illusions that, you know, this is going to extend my life and I'm going to live till I'm 105, but it does make you feel better. So that's the key, you know. And I mean, whether it's this or respiratory rehab or cardiac rehab, it makes you feel better, which is the key to daily living with chronic disease.
Peterson and the group practice on simple tunes to help ease the stress on the harmonica playing newbies. Facilitator Jessica Kraft says some of the simplest and easiest to learn songs are holiday tunes.
Christmas songs. So we have Up on the Housetop, Deck the Halls.
See how bad we can butcher Silent Night.
That's a hard song.
That is it? A very hard song. Yeah. I think we've tried that before.
You're doing good.
Lynn Scott, who played Silent Night, shrugged off the praise. She said she comes to the harmonica therapy because it helps her feel less isolated.
You meet a lot of people that are kind of in the same boat as you are, so that makes you feel not so like you're the only one, because none of my friends have lung issues.
So again, make sure.
With Silent Night in the rearview mirror, the group dials back the degree of difficulty.
Jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh. Yay! That was good! That was good! All right, how do we feel?
Dizzy.
All right, well, hey, you know what? That comes with it. So just make sure we're practicing our pursed-lip breathing throughout this whole thing, okay? In through that nose, smell the flowers, blow out through the mouth, blowing out that birthday candle. Afterwards, if you are not out of breath in some way, shape, or form, lightheaded, dizzy, something like that, even though please do not continue doing it if you are dizzy, okay? Just stop whenever you need to. But typically, if you experience any type of those symptoms or something, you are doing it correctly. You're exercising those lungs like you need to.
Mary Jo Bragg of Lexington says she has noticed improvement in her breathing after taking just two sessions of the therapy.
It kind of makes me a little more conscious of how I should be inhaling and exhaling. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. I think it does help.
At the end of each session, Kraft asks the group if they're willing to share any concerns they have about their chronic health conditions. Bragg says she's struggling with the high humidity and how that adds to the struggle of getting by in hot weather. Peterson says the heat and humidity caused him to miss out on an important family outing.
My family's going to see the Cubs Wednesday, and I'm not going because it's 90 degrees, and I can't breathe.
Yeah.
So I can't make it from the train station to Wrigley Field and up in my seat because I can't breathe. I'll be hyperventilating and calling 911, you know? So I stay home in the air conditioning.
Oh, when the Saints go marching.
Exercise physiologist and facilitator Jessica Kraft says the group is looking to expand the harmonica therapy group sizes. She says, though they're designed for people coping with breathing issues, that's not a prerequisite. She says sessions are open for anyone and they're free. The more people attend, the more beautiful the music, she says. She smiles coyly as she describes the result that way, beautiful music. One of the therapy participants described it as making a joyful noise. I'm Willis Kern.
The hour-long harmonica therapy sessions are held each month at the OSF St. Joseph Medical Center's cardiopulmonary wing in Bloomington. Babies as young as a year and a half old expect those they view as leaders to intervene when they see someone not being treated fairly. That's according to some new research from the University of Illinois. It was published in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. The findings add to the growing evidence that children in their second year of life have a well-developed understanding of social hierarchies and power dynamics. To learn more, Christine Herman spoke with the lead researcher, Renee Byerjean, a psychology professor at the Infant Cognition Lab on the U of I's Urbana campus.
The idea that, like a young child, would be frustrated if wronged, that was well established. I think all parents in the universe would believe that.
Yeah.
But what we're asking is not whether the child will be frustrated, like that little victim whose toy was stolen. What we were asking here is about the response of the leader, so the parent or the daycare teacher. So what we're showing is that when these transgressions occur, babies evaluate parents and other leaders and say, well, you saw this transgression. You know this is not fair. Are you going to do something about it? Mm-hmm. And if you don't, then you are shirking your responsibilities and it makes you less of a leader, less of a parent.
So how did you actually go about studying this? Because a 1.5-year-old can't say, hey, that's unfair. How do you actually measure when a baby feels that something they are viewing is not fair?
So we take advantage here of a very well-established method that's used by many researchers in the field. It's called the violation of expectation method. It's a looking time method. And like most methods that are used with babies, it takes advantage of babies' natural response. So in day-to-day life, when babies see something unexpected, so they're looking at the world, events are unfolding, they're trying to predict how the events will progress. When something doesn't go as expected, they tend to look longer at it because it means their little model of the world wasn't quite right. They expected A and they see B. So, something is wrong. They have to revise their model of the world so that next time they better predict events. So in this case, what we show them is a leader who intervenes when seeing a within group transgression and a leader who doesn't intervene. And babies look longer when the leader doesn't intervene. When the protagonist is a non-leader, as I said, they look equally at the event. So it's not that they prefer interventions in general and so on. It's only when the protagonist is a leader that we see that expectation. What this is telling us is that babies have a very abstract expectation of leaders or authority figures. Babies evaluate others constantly with reference to, are you acting fairly? Are you showing proper in-group support? Are you acting in accordance with your responsibilities as a leader? And you are either a good one or a not so good one.
This is so fascinating to just think about how the minds of babies work and how they really operate very similarly to adults, even at such a young age. It's fascinating.
They're born with these initial expectations, but then in each culture makes decisions about exactly how to implement them, which ones to give more emphasis to, or when they suggest different courses of action, which one should be given priority? Do you go with in-group support or do you go with fairness, for example? And in some cultures, you have to go with in-group support over fairness. So there's rampant nepotism. In other cultures, you go to jail if you do that. Fairness is considered more important. But what's interesting is what's this universal picture of human moral cognition that babies are born with that kind of orient them to think in the right way about their social world, and then they will learn from their cultures exactly, you know, what to pay attention to, how to implement it, and so on. It's very fun research.
That's U of I psychology professor Renee Byerjean speaking with Christine Herman. Pregnant women need to stay healthy to keep themselves and their babies safe. For those struggling with drug use, that can be extra difficult. Addiction treatment for pregnant women is rare. But as Sarah Fenton with St. Louis Public Radio reports, a clinic wants to make sure moms-to-be get the help they need.
21-year-old B grew up in St. Louis. She started using opioids when she was 16. After moving around the country and trying to quit several times, she came back, hoping for a fresh start. But she had untreated mental health problems, and after a few months, she started using again. She had a chest cold one day and went to urgent care. A nurse called her over and said they needed to talk.
And I just didn't really know if it was true. It was really scary.
B was 14 weeks pregnant, and she was still using heroin and fentanyl.
I knew I wanted to be a mom, for sure, but I didn't know how I was going to be able to do that when I was in the middle of a really dark time for myself.
We're not using B's name to protect her privacy. She knew she needed help for her baby and to treat her addiction. With her mom, she found a clinic at Washington University, which treats pregnant women with substance use disorder.
So I think it was about maybe 15 minutes later, I got a call back from the doctor that I still see now.
It was Jeannie Kelly, the medical director of the care clinic. It opened last year to help patients like B who need addiction treatment along with pregnancy care.
So we wanted to create a one-stop shop for these patients.
Kelly says there's a shortage of addiction treatment for all people who need help, but that need is especially acute for moms. Some doctors drop their patients when they find out they're pregnant.
We've even seen patients who have had established relationships with doctors and providers who treat these disorders who then tell them when they're pregnant, we're no longer able to take care of you.
Every week, patients meet with specially trained neonatologists, counselors, and psychiatrists. They can get medicine like buprenorphine and methadone that helps manage addiction. Kelly says pregnancy allows doctors to help women who might not otherwise seek treatment.
And they're seeking medical attention, potentially for the first time in years. It represents this great opportunity to basically connect with these patients from the medical community.
She says patients with addiction are more likely to be dealing with other problems that keep them from going to the doctor and staying on track. That's where Brittany Vaughn comes in.
I am literally there for them all day. Like, some patients text me, some call me. I talk to each patient at least once a week.
Vaughn's official title is Nurse Navigator, but patients at the care clinic know her as a person who helps them get whatever they need. That could be helping them find housing, transportation, or getting insurance approval for their medicine. Sometimes she'll just listen.
They're used to being so judged that they think that everybody's judging them. So when they notice that myself and my coworkers, we don't, and we're really there to support them, that makes a world of difference. Like, you can tell when someone trusts you.
Vaughn was B's nurse. B was worried about what the neonatal intensive care unit was going to be like. About half of babies born to women at the clinic need to visit the NICU to get treated for withdrawal symptoms.
So that was, like, scary. Like, I've never, you know, been in a NICU. I've never seen, you know, little tiny babies in little boxes.
Vaughn arranged a tour of the NICU so B wouldn't be so nervous. That kind of support is important after women give birth, too. That's when the risk of relapse is the highest, and why the clinic psychiatrist sees patients for months after they deliver. But pregnancy is also a powerful motivator. That was true for B.
Like, now I'm living to give her a life, you know, that a different life than I had.
She gave birth to her baby a few weeks ago. She says they're both tired, but they're doing okay. I'm Sarah Fenton, St. Louis Public Radio.
Statewide just ahead, rural food deserts, and what some are trying to do about the problem. That story is on the way. This is Statewide. On the way, the Illinois River will be shutting down to barge traffic for a few months next year. We'll find out about the work to be done and how farmers are getting prepared. Next, people have been leaving rural Midwestern areas for decades, and it's not just population loss. Often fresh food sellers move away too. There might be some hope, though. Tim Shelley reports on how four central Illinois towns are fighting for fresh food as well as community survival.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture defines a food desert as a census tract with a lot of low-income people or low access to a grocery store. Rural areas more than 10 miles from a grocery store qualify as a food desert. The nonprofit organization Feeding America says 2.4 million rural households face hunger, and 75% of the counties with the highest rates of food insecurity are in rural areas. This includes central Illinois. Several rural towns have seen their only grocery stores disappear in recent years. Delvin Finer Foods burned down 5 years ago, leaving the Tazewell County community without a grocery store. No one rebuilt it. In February of this year, Minunk's Grossenbach Grocery closed for good. Chris Merritt is a director of the Illinois Institute for Rural Affairs at Western Illinois University. He says many stores haven't been able to weather the hollowing out of rural America.
Grocery stores have always been a narrow profit margin industry to begin with, very competitive. And quite simply, there are grocery stores in small towns that have just gone out of business.
Dollar General stores and gas station convenience stores have filled the void in many small towns, leading to what one expert calls food swamps rather than food deserts, because they sell food, but it's frozen or canned and not fresh. Sean Park is the program manager at the Institute's Value-Added Sustainable Development Center. He says in many cases, Dollar General goods are just cheap enough to drive out mom-and-pop grocers.
What happens then is the community is left with nobody that sells fresh produce, fresh meat, those types of items.
Park says he's trying to help Toulon, Delavan, Princeville, and Mount Pulaski bring back fresh food. In Princeville, the Village Foods grocery store closed about a year ago. Mayor Jeff Troutman says a school district survey to assess village food wants and needs garnered more than 400 responses. Princeville School District 326 Superintendent Shannon Dooling and Princeville State Bank are working with Sean Park and the Value Added Sustainable Development Center to open a co-op grocery store run by the school district and assisted by students. Park says students in the high school's agricultural program could sell their food in a store, and students with special needs could work there. Meanwhile, Jim Nolan is working to open Ben & Julie's in a converted hardware store in Toulon. In addition to fresh food, Nolan says the store will have a deli, a cafe, and a delivery service. In this age of convenience, Nolan says it's not enough to be only a grocery.
We live in a world of in which convenience is demanded, not only in big cities, but also in small towns.
Western Illinois' Merritt agrees. He says a small town loses something more than just a source of food when a grocery store goes under. It's social center.
It can be a real gut punch, if you will, when a small town loses its grocery store, because it's more than simply a place to buy cereal.
But opening a grocery store in a small town requires more than a blend of services. Tori Dahlhoff is the Rural Development Coordinator for the Greater Peoria Economic Development Council.
It's kind of a all-hands-on-deck approach that's needed, where it's community-supported, but it's also driven by technology and innovation to really come up with some different and new models that don't exist yet.
Dahlhoff says the EDC focuses on building a supply chain from farms to the dinner table. He says the region already has farmers growing specialty crops, mills processing raw materials, and community grocery stores selling the final product, but they're uncoordinated.
There are all these great little projects happening, but it's not happening at any real scale yet that could feed more people.
The U.S. EPA's Local Foods, Local Places program might also help develop a supply chain. Peoria and Mount Pulaski in Logan County are among 14 selected communities nationwide. Dahlhoff says he hopes having an urban and a rural community in the year-long program will generate new solutions to food insecurity. Jim Nolan of Toulon says small communities and mid-sized towns must find a niche as major cities attract more talent.
Well, I don't have a magic wand, and so I don't know the answers, but I do know the first step is to focus on what these cities and small towns can be.
Ultimately, the fate of grocery stores in rural America may be tied to the fate of small towns themselves. I'm Tim Shelley.
Next year could prove a challenge for farmers who rely on shipping commodities along the Illinois River. A big portion of the river will shut down for an estimated 4 months in late spring and summer of 2020. It's being done to repair six locks and dams. Kirby Wagner's with the Illinois Farm Bureau and says his organization is urging farmers to plan ahead.
Well, I think that anybody who relies on river transportation is going to have an issue. They're going to need to reroute, redetermine, and plan to not be able to use the river for up to 4 months. I think that these closures can cause those problems. I do think there's alternatives, but I think it's going to be a bigger problem if plans aren't made before 2020 gets here.
Well, you talked about some of the problems that they might occur with that. Is that problems getting the materials they need through, or getting, you know, anything that they need to get to market? Is that going to be more of a problem?
I would guess that it's going to be more on the market side of things. A lot of the inputs and a lot of the other things that come up river, a lot of those suppliers are planning for massive amounts of storage. They're planning to bring in a little bit more than normal and hold on to those inputs. Now, on the grain side of things and on everything that's going to go down the river, that's where the problems are probably going to occur. We're going to need to find new ways to get things south of St. Louis and down into New Orleans or throughout the country, and I think that's where the real issue is going to lie.
I saw some of the scheduling that had been put out by the Army Corps of Engineers, and it seemed as though they were trying to avoid some of the busiest times, including trying to get most of the work wrapped up before harvest time, but there's going to be an overlap most likely.
Yes, the Corps did a great job of putting their heads together with the navigation industry to say, hey, when can we do these closures? And they're going to close six of the locks. So instead of doing one closure every year, they're doing them all at once. And so that seems to be more productive instead of having a shutdown several years in a row. And then additionally, the timing of it is important. They believe from their data that is the lower shipping period. And in coordination with the flood season, they want to make sure that the locks aren't flooded while they're doing the work. So they kind of coordinated the approach and scheduled the timeline around those factors.
You talked about planning ahead, and that's something that farmers are going to have to probably do next year. What are some of the things that you're advising them to be prepared for?
Well, first of all, we want to make sure that they're getting with their regional marketers and those who are helping them do their planning for the year. And we're saying, hey, you just get together with them ahead of time so that you have a plan. If you're really relying on river transportation to move everything you got, we're going to need to find some alternative methods. So we think it's a real regional impact. While most of the state could be affected, we think that those who rely solely on the river are going to need to really do some work.
For those that don't really follow the navigation of the Illinois River, this work, well, it's a temporary headache. There's definitely going to be some long-term benefits to getting some of these locks replaced.
Absolutely. So some of these locks have exceeded their lifespan by maybe 25 to 50 years, depending on which lock it is. And so with that fact, these locks are delaying. So getting things all the way down the river is causing delays because of how slow these locks are able to function. So sometimes you're seeing an extreme delay just to get all the way through the system, and it's causing issues with your delivery. So having these locks working properly will help get commodities moved down the river more effectively.
Do you think there's going to be any type of market impact as far as prices? Is it going to be that disruptive?
It's possible. There's factors that could change what I say in 10 minutes. The market could be impacted, yes. The marketing folks that we've talked to seem to think that there's going to be a spot for the grain to go. But you've got another year that a lot of factors could change anything that we say today. We need to have our locks updated, and I think it's easily forgotten about. I think most people realize that, yes, commodities move on the river, but just how important our river system is to agriculture. And so we're really excited that these locks are getting updated.
Kirby Wagner is Assistant Director of Infrastructure and Transportation for the Illinois Farm Bureau. We talked to him about work along the Illinois River next year that will cause a temporary shutdown of river traffic. You can find out more at our website, statewideshow.com. Sci-fi writers have long warned us about the dangers of modifying organisms. Remember Jurassic Park? But new futuristic gene editing technologies are becoming a reality. And Madeline Beck with Harvest Public Media talked with researchers about how to present the new tools to a long, skeptical public.
This is the sound of giant locusts attacking towns in Illinois. It's from a 1957 movie called Beginning of the End. Basically, a scientist used radiation to make giant fruits and veggies. Pesky grasshoppers got in, ate some radioactive stuff.
Well, their cell division accelerated immediately. That is, they started to grow abnormally fast.
Giant killer locusts probably aren't that big of a threat, but the movie demonstrates our long-held fear of messing with nature. But a real-life revolt against gene editing came up when the public found out just how much food was being genetically modified.
If you put something out where the public isn't comfortable with it, it's not, doesn't matter what the science says. Once their mind is made up, they're not comfortable with it. It can be very hard to reverse it.
Stephen Moose researches and teaches crop genetics at the University of Illinois. He says that the fear of GMOs might have been avoided if the public had been let into decision-making processes from the beginning. And he says we should do that with new gene editing technology, like with CRISPR, something that makes it easier to edit genes, or with this kind of crazy thing called gene drive.
So gene drive is a case where you alter the outcome of inheritance. There are rules, and you can, if you understand how that process works, you can make it violate the rules.
So let's say we edit a mosquito gene so it's born with a trait that's bad for it, even kills it. Usually, baby skeeters born without that trait would survive and take over. Evolution. But what if we make it so 100% of offspring get that killer trait? That's gene drive.
Eventually, it basically creates a dead end, you know, a genetic dead end.
The population collapses. And while it may be decades off from regulatory approval, researchers are making baby steps, like with water hemp and Palmer amaranth, some of the nastiest weeds Midwest farmers battle. The University of Illinois' Patrick Tranel studies the plants and is looking into using gene drives on them. But let's be clear, he's nowhere near a finished product. They're just now trying to find the genes that they'd eventually need to edit.
So yeah, I mean, we're a long ways away at this point.
And any approved gene drive will likely require some sort of failsafe or kill switch to make sure it doesn't wipe out a species.
So it's not our go to eradicate water hemp from the face of the earth. Nobody wants to do that. Even though it's a weed, I'm sure it has some benefits to some organism somewhere.
But Tranel says this research is important because it could help overcome herbicide resistance, reduce the need for herbicides like Roundup and dicamba, and help us produce more food for a growing world. Along a similar vein, Omar Akbari at the University of California, San Diego, is researching how to use gene drives to potentially deal with an invasive fly. And it certainly sounds like the star of a sci-fi thriller, Drosophila suzuki. It infests fruits and berries in a pretty intense way.
Females have a serrated ovipositor. Essentially, it's like a knife that is on their posterior end, and it enables them to stab the fruit with this knife and inject their eggs into the fruit.
Eggs inside a fruit are hard to kill. But Akbari says they're looking at other ways to handicap the fly beyond gene drive because that tech is so far off. Still, he and Tranel and Moose agree. The public needs to come along on these early steps for gene drive to ever be tried in the field. They're not even asking for full support. They just want the public to make knowledgeable decisions based on costs and benefits. And of course, no scientist wants to be personally responsible for unleashing some sort of sci-fi plague onto the Earth.
I'm talking about giant locusts. Giant locusts are responsible for all of this.
Madeline Beck, Harvest Public Media.
That does it for another episode of Statewide. We're glad you could be with us. Join us at this time next week for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Find this episode and all the others at statewideshow.com. You can also get our podcast through the NPR One app. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois public radio stations.